Brought you on the Arms Room Show with Glenn.
And Drew.
And thank you to all of our patrons for being willing to continue to support the show and to support what else we do through independence training with the community programs that we are able to put on. And for keeping the show alive, patrons, you guys make it happen, and we really appreciate you. A couple things going on for our patrons. Don't forget about this. Number one, show ideas. My God, people, send your show topics in. We almost have to, like, beg people to do it. And then as soon as they do it, we do their show within a few weeks. And they're like, oh, hey, thanks for doing my show. And I'm like, I've fucking been telling you about this shit for months. Just send me a show topic, and we're happy to do it as long as it's not something we, like, just did. But, you know, this is how we come up with our show topic ideas, is from our listeners. Sometimes all we need is this one person, you know, to say something. Sometimes several people, especially over a few months, will request something and we'll go ahead and do it, or I'll track down a guest or whatever that works for that. Or if we have a guest and we're trying to, you know, convince them, not necessarily convince them, but let them know, like, hey, the show would be important for you. We have people who are requesting you. Then that's beneficial. But anyways, that's thing number one. Thing number two for you guys is the Patron Question Show. That's going to be on October 18th. Today's show is September the 20th. So October 18th. So you got to just right out about a month to submit your questions. Anything you want to ask us, we'll answer, right? I mean, we have to be able to answer us. Don't ask what the fucking meaning of life is or something. I have no idea. I'm almost 38 years old. I got enough fucking clue. I'm still trying to figure out what the hell, who I am. So don't ask me that kind of shit. But definitely ask, you know, questions about what we do professionally, personal lives, whatever. We're happy to answer those questions for our patrons. So you got to be a patron, but there's plenty of you out there. And you have a month. So hopefully you'll, you know, catch up on the shows. For those of you guys who are a little behind, you'll hear these shows. We'll be talking about it every week up to that show. That's going to be October the 18th show. So make sure that you submit your questions via email, info@trainingaz.com. info@trainingaz.com. Submit your questions and we'll get them answered. We're doing this show a couple days early because we are going to be out of town when this show – actually, we're coming kind of sort of back into town during this show, but we're doing the show a little early, so I don't really know what the news is. Nothing?
Nothing.
Politicians are still corrupt.
There's some guy that killed his fiance because they got into a fight or something like that. That they're now, it's some big thing going on.
No idea.
Nationally, I guess.
No clue.
Couple shootings in Phoenix.
There's been a bunch of, you know, madness with the vaccine-related stuff. Obviously, all kinds of science coming out. You got the president who's just, you know, whatever. You got all these big events with celebrities and shit not wearing masks and, quote-unquote, they are vaccinated, not vaccinated. We don't know. You got AOC showing up to a rich thing with a thing that says tax the rich and at a $35,000 a plate event. Like, the world is mad. The world has gone mad. I feel like
well, then we got that whatever TikTok thing from the school saying that there's some TikTok video going around saying to
break school property, yeah, steal school property,
which is insane.
Challenging kids, like it's the new Tide Pod challenge or whatever. Like, yeah, absolutely. I literally sent the kids an email and said, don't fucking do this shit.
Yeah.
That was my actual dad email to my children. So you guys want to know what it's like to live with me. That's pretty much sums it up. But yeah, so the world's it's a freaking crazy place. You should be preparing your people more for whatever the hell is coming down the road. I don't know. Everybody thinks that they have it the worst. I did read an interesting concept the other day that technically colonial British rule in colonial America actually allowed for more freedoms than the current administration allows for. So whatever. All right. On to the red wire gear moment. Excuse me. I have to yawn.
He was almost here today.
John almost made it.
Almost.
Lube and maintain your pocket knife. A couple things we see often with pocket knives. People forget to lube them, especially auto openers or quick openers or even just thumb stud openers. Don't forget, every now and then, man, you got to take a little Q-tip, take a little oil, take a little lube, whatever, and clean out the working mechanisms of your pocket knife. It's in your pocket. It gets dirty and linty and nasty and all that. You want to make sure there's no rust and maintain that bad boy. Make sure that it's as sharp as you can make it and try to keep it that way as much as possible. That way, when you need it for administrative tasks or, God forbid, to do more than that, it is ready to roll and it's not going to fail you. I don't care whether it's, you know, one of my favorite $30 style Kershaw blades, you know, from that I usually buy like in five packs. And as they get busted up, I just get rid of them, or I've given brand new ones away to people or whatever. Someone's like, I don't have a pocket knife. I got a good one for you. I like those things just in case I lose them. I got a couple really nice Benchmades too. And it doesn't really matter whether it's my $30, you know, cheap little Kershaw or whether it's my $200 Benchmade. Take care of your equipment so that way it will take care of you. Redwire Gear Moment brought to you by RedwireGear.com. Today's topic, I'm kind of excited to talk about. It is precision shooting for the civilian LARPer. And this was a show topic, not just a show topic sent in by a listener, but this listener has actually sent in a couple of these outlines before, and I love this stuff. A couple of you guys actually have sent these in to us before, and I really enjoy them. And it's basically not just a show topic, but like, hey, as long as you're going to talk about this, here's some things I would like to hear you talk about. Here's some concepts or some, you know, topics specifically within this topic that I want you to cover. And, you know, it's like a little one-page outline or whatever. So that's awesome. And we're going to be doing that today with this precision shooting for the civilian LARPer. So let's get right into it. So first of all, we want to look at what precision shooting is, all right? And so precision shooting to us is being able to make an accurate, repeatable, consistent impact at any range with any weapon system. So right off the bat, let's kind of get that definition out of the way. For us, if someone says, oh, I shot this thing at XYZ distance, then our first questions, usually three of them, are going to be, okay, how big was the target, you know, compared to the range? How many times did it take you to hit it? And can you do it again? Those are the ways that personally I judge precision. If I make a mile-long shot and I make it one time and it takes me 20 rounds to get there and it's on a, you know, I don't know, 50-inch target, it's not really that impressive. You know, it isn't, unless I can consistently continue to do it again. Now, precision shooting in this aspect, we're talking about rifles and what separates rifles long-range rifle from precision rifle. Well, for us, long-range is a relative term. When I was growing up, I never shot a big-game animal past 120 yards. It was the farthest big-game animal shot I'd ever taken. So it wasn't until I went through basic training that I shot up to 300 meters, and it blew my freaking mind. I was like, whoa, that thing is so far away. My dad used to make us, after we'd zero the rifle, the hunting rifle, at 100, he would take a little like 8-inch dinner plate, like one of the little paper plates, and we would staple it up or tape it or whatever on a cardboard box at like 200 yards, and we'd have to shoot it from a couple different positions, and we just have to put the round into that paper plate, right? That's a 4-minute of angle target for those of you guys keeping track. That's freaking huge. But with typical hunting rifles that we were using, with typical hunting ammunition, whatever, man, we were happy to hit the plate. And as long as we could hit the plate, Dad was happy with us doing that, basically telling us, like, never take a shot like that, because you can't be as accurate at that range as you can at 100. And we were typically shooting, you know, 4-power fixed scopes, usually some, you know, relatively inexpensive Bushnell or Nikon or something like that. So growing up, I had a very different equipment than I have now, shooting Winchester Model 70s. And, you know, my first deer rifle was a Marlin 1895, 1895, yeah, guide gun with the lever guns and 35 Remington. God, I miss that gun. I would give just about anything to get that freaking gun back. That was a badass freaking rifle. But anyways, badass little setup. But I mean, yeah, probably a, you know, 4-power Bushnell, you know, $200 scope or something like that on top. So 100 yards was plenty for us. I think 120 yards about the farthest I ever shot. And most of the animals that we kill were inside of 100 yards. So long range to me was really anything past 200 yards. That seemed like long range. Obviously, as I've progressed in my life, now long range to me, I'm like, dude, if it's not 1,000 yards, it's not long range. And then that's kind of based on the system too. Like if I'm shooting 5.56, well, then 500 yards is long range, because beyond that, depending on the rifle that you're shooting, you kind of are getting, you know, shitty results. If I'm shooting my AK, like really anything past 300 is long range, just based on the capability of the round. I'm not saying the round can't go past that. I'm just saying that based on the capability of the round, past 300-400 yards, that's when you start to get to long range. If I'm shooting 22s, quite honestly, anything past 100 is long range. You know, and I know there's these guys making 1,000-yard 22 shots, and that's really neat, but I'm talking about for your average 22 rifle, anything past 100 yards is a pretty pretty long-range shot to me based on the capabilities of the ammunition. If you're talking about pistols, really for most people, anything past 25 or you know 50 at the most is kind of long-range shooting. Hell, for some people, anything past about 7 or 10 yards is considered long-range pistol shooting. So it's really based on your set, your skill set, your tools, the capability of the caliber you're shooting, you know, other factors like that. So what does long-range mean to you? Okay, answer that question, so be it. Long-range is just hitting shit far away. That's it. And whatever that long-range is, well, that's what it is to you like we just described. But precision, precision is that repeatable, consistent accuracy. So, like I said, three questions we're going to ask about precision are going to be, what size was the target? How many shots did it take you to hit it? Can you do it again? And again. And again. In all conditions. If even if the wind is blowing, right? Can we make that hit? Can we be consistent? So already, just so you guys know, that's kind of precision for us. Okay. Now, for the civilian LARPer, I'm going to remove the hunting for a second, because the ethical debate on how far away you should be shooting animals is a debate that I don't want to get into on the show right now. Whatever, okay? We're talking non-competitive, so not shooting for rifle matches, okay? We're talking non-professionally team-based, meaning you're not part of a sniper team on Overwatch, you know, for the most part. You're not professionally using this rifle every day, all day. Generally speaking, you're not probably going to have a spotter, so you're going to be self-correcting your hits. And there's not going to be any kind of extract for you, meaning if you engage somebody with the rifle, either you're going to have to be successful, you're going to have to expect getting return fire, or you may have to transition from that weapon system to something else. So we're literally talking about LARPing right now, okay? Live action role playing, as we jokingly call it. We're talking about the end of the world. Oh my God, is precision shooting important? We have people come to us for this training, for the hunting, competitive, and professional team-based stuff. That's fine. We do have people come to us and go, I'm concerned about the way things are going, and I want to be able to shoot this rifle, whatever that setup is, further. It could be anything from an AR-15 to a high-powered rifle or big bore, you know, large caliber something. So consider this. This is kind of the context that we were given here for the show. All right, so we're gonna live in fantasy land for a second. This is not my favorite place to be, guys, okay, because I like to be practical, but we're going to live in fantasy land for just the next little bit on the show, okay? Let's consider that we're in a country in some type of civil unrest, some kind of civil war maybe even. It's modern, so we have the tools that we have today, and it's some kind of situation where you, even for the time, you know, short time being, are going to have to protect you and yours. And some people are like, oh, but come on now, Glenn, that's not realistic. Really? Why don't you check out the fucking LA riots? Where do you think they came up with the term rooftop Korean? All right. There were literally Koreans on top of their stores killing people from the roof. That happened in America. Those stores, their shops, their neighborhoods are all that they have. So when people talk about self-defense or defense of what's yours, it's a defense of your life. That to them was self-defense. They were defending what was theirs. This store is their livelihood. It's their whole life. It's their life savings. It's everything to them. It's their only source of income. This is their life. This is self-defense to them. It's not the first or the only time it's ever going to happen in our country. So let's be realistic here. Okay, now that we're in fantasy land and also possibly practical application land, that is fantasy land right now because it's not happening right now and it may happen in the future. Okay, let's go. Probably single operator, so to speak, in a worst possible scenario. I can't stress enough that if you find yourself in a situation, all right, look, anybody who's ever played a video game like Call of Duty can tell you what a camper is, right? It's a sniper, someone with a scope rifle or whatever who's going to set up someplace where he's hard to be found and he's just going to lay there and freaking shoot people. And it's annoying. And everybody makes it their goal in this digital world to hunt this fucker down And usually they'll knife him to death and then teabag him with their little character, right? It happened in Halo. It's happened in Call of Duty. It's happened all the way back when I was a teenager, back when the internet was first fucking invented, all right? And we were, you know, playing some of the very first Delta Force was the name of this first-person shooter I used to play back in the 90s. And even then, you know, you would find these damn campers. They'd get up on this hill and they'd make these shitty long shots on people and it was annoying, right? You're like, come down here and fight me, you know? The reason I would even bring that up is because in the end, that person always got killed. Someone found them and calls an airstrike on them. Someone goes up there and kills them, right? Someone's like, together, like, look, the three of us are technically against each other, but in this game, we're going to help each other hunt this dude down and then we'll part ways, right? Like, that kind of shit really does happen. Guess what happens in real life? Same shit. So being a solo, uno, shoot, move kind of guy, while effective if you're particularly well-trained and good at it, is a great way to end up dead very quickly by someone who can flank you or overwhelm you or just sneak up behind you while you're looking through your optic, right? So short of, you know, tripwiring your entire hide, which would take – be incredibly time-intensive and preclude you from being able to do the quick movement thing I was talking about earlier, it's a really great idea to go out and work in a team. That's why most snipers work in a team. There's a couple things you have to consider. One, rear security. Rear security is incredibly important if you're going to work in this environment, okay? Now – let me set this up by saying I'm not an operational sniper, nor have I ever been one, okay? So just take that for what it's worth from my experiences professionally working in these environments, working around these people, and now also training these people from these perspectives, okay? So if you are a professional sniper and you're like, no, hold on there a second, buddy. Okay, fine. You have your fucking opinion. Awesome. But remember, we're not talking about being necessarily in a professional environment. I'm talking about me with a chest rig and, you know, a light pack with a rifle and my partner with a chest rig and a light pack and a rifle. And, you know, we're trying to move and shoot through this environment. That's all I'm talking about here. So it is beneficial for you to have some rear security. If you can have more than one, even better. Generally speaking, for this kind of shooting, it's best to be removed to an area from like a quote-unquote overwatch position or a higher, you know, position where you actually have the capability to have the maximum visibility. Minimal visibility is a good way to end up dead real quick because now all someone has to do is sneak up on you and that's not very hard. So maximum visibility and some kind of really good standoff distance. The standoff distance you should select should be specifically based on the type of opposition you expect to face. Are people throwing rocks? Are people shooting pistols? Are they shooting carbines? Are they shooting rifles? Do they have artillery? This will tell you all the kind of things you need to know for what kind of overhead protection I need to have, what kind of standoff distance I need to have, how good my hide needs to be constructed, if it needs to be constructed, or am I literally just rooftop careening this shit? All right, that may be it, all right? Having a spotter is also incredibly beneficial because a lot of times a spotter is looking at the entire environment, whereas an individual shooter, I'm only seeing what I'm seeing. Can only see so much. So in a setup like that, solo uno operator, not very beneficial, guys. Never really a good idea. That should not be your plan. That's what you should do if, oh shit, everything's not working out and this also isn't working out. And now I have to go to the rooftop and handle my business. That is a bad place to be. All right. You don't want to be up there, right? So you want to have some kind of spotter is my point. Now, it's really hard in self-defense. I can't even think of a situation where I could articulate a precision rifle application in self-defense. In self-defense. Not crime prevention, not third defense, not none of that. In self-defense, I cannot currently think of a way I could articulate to a court of law, a judge, a jury that I needed to shoot this person and take their life with a precision rifle at those kinds of distances. And I'm going to say that's anything further than about 20 yards where it was absolutely positively necessary to take this shot because if I didn't, they would X. And there are some people like, well, what if they also had a rifle? Well, then it sounds a lot more like I'm probably proactively putting myself in this situation, right? If I climb up onto the roof to defend my home, let's say, from roving bands of marauders, and I'm engaging them with rifles and someone else shows up with a rifle, that's not a self-defense situation. I'm proactively on the roof shooting people. That's not self-defense if someone else shows up to try to shoot me. If anything, it might be a case for self-defense for them, right? So the point being is I can't really think of anything where that would really be articulated. Those are close-range weapons that are way better for that. So now we look at what does this quote-unquote Red Dawn precision rifle look like? All right, so let's talk about some of the more common questions that we get. And if you have some other questions, please feel free to email them to us, info@trainingaz.com. We're happy to answer your questions or, you know, jump on social media, drop us a DM or something. If you're like, well, what about this? Well, what about that? Well, my uncle and then my buddy and I was a Navy SEAL. Okay, cool, awesome. I'd love to hear it. Send us a message and let's hear it. I'm going to talk about the more common things to consider. One of the first questions we get asked, of course, is semi-auto versus bolt. Do I get a semi-automatic or do I get a bolt? Inherently, the bolt guns are going to be more accurate. Inherently. That being said, semi-autos are also incredibly accurate, especially if you get the right setup. If you buy the right gun, a precision-based platform, you can have a very accurate gun. For example, I've got a semi-automatic AR-10 and 6.5 Creedmoor. I also have a bolt action in 6.5 Creedmoor. All things being equal between the two systems, my bolt gun still outperforms accuracy-wise over longer ranges. I can easily reach out past 1,200, 1,300 yards with my 6.5 bolt. With my gas gun, it starts to peter out a little bit earlier because some of that gas is bled off operating the gas system and the inherent inaccuracies of a semi-automatic operating system, which we don't have a ton of time to get into, so I'm just going to leave it at that. What is your fantasy situation looking like? If I'm thinking target-rich environment on the rooftop of my house, I want a semi-automatic, hands down. I want something magazine-fed with a 20 or 30-round magazine or more. And, you know, I'd love to have like a 100-round drum for my AR-10, to be quite honest with you. That way you could just lay in a position or, you know, shoot, move, and not have to worry about reloading a lot. Of course, adding in that extra weight of what that would freaking weigh would be a ton, but I wouldn't have to be reloading a lot. So semi-auto versus bolt gun. What's the application of the gun? Am I going to be laying up at that wonderful, great, long standoff distance, making precision shot after precision shot? Then, yeah, I want bolt gun. If I'm going to be up and in it or might have to use this gun up close, like, for example, getting to said position, then, yes, I want a semi-auto. I want to have to be sitting here working that bolt, trying to fight someone at close range. No, thank you. Now, I'm not saying it can't be done. One of our students and kind of a peer as an instructor for both law enforcement and on his own private sector is a badass sniper for a local SWAT team. And he comes to our Independence Day Action Rifle match typically and for the last several years has run his 308 16-inch work gun, bolt gun. And he does great. He's not last place. He's doing a very good job. This year he kind of surprised me by running a what was he running, an M1 Garand or something like that?
Yeah,
M14. He's running an M14.
Yeah.
And he still did great. Point being, that's where your application is semi versus bolt. You also want to consider in this Red Dawn situation, bolt guns, easier to maintain, less moving parts, less stuff to break, easier to keep them clean. Semi-auto guns, more moving parts, more to maintain. You're going to need some extra parts. You have to make sure those things are well lubed. If you're going to suppress them, they're going to get even dirtier. Magazines, you got to keep them clean. You got to have a lot of them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So consider that if you're going to do that.
Or just get an AK.
Well, that would be a semi-auto.
Yeah, but you don't have to worry about cleaning it.
Yeah, we're talking about precision systems here, Drew. You show me a precision AK, I'll buy it for you. We have accurate AKs. Our Lee Armory AKs are very accurate.
They are.
Well, they ain't no precision tool. I think you found that out in field carbine.
Yeah.
Well, Drew was a little disappointed in field carbine.
No,
first
I
time
was
she took
impressed.
It,
I was
and
pretty
she
impressed.
Took that AK out.
I was pretty impressed for how far I got it out.
You were working it out there, but your consistency and on
that
the AK starts to shit the bed around about 300.
Yeah.
You know. Now, we have some buddies who shoot AKs, some of our friends and our clients who love to shoot AKs. They shoot them competitively, and they've really tricked them out, and they've tuned them up, and they're badass freaking guns. And yes, they get further out more consistently. It's your standard off-the-shelf AK. 300 yards is what you ought to expect, and that's kind of what it was freaking built for. All right, so let's look at calibers, common calibers. If it was me and I could have one gun, one bolt gun, one semi-auto, I would choose in 7.62x51. I would shoot a 308 Winchester or 7.62x51 chambered gas or bolt gun, depending on what I settle on. Why would I want that? First of all, it's a NATO round. It's easy to find the ammo. Second of all, there's a shitload of ammo out there. Mm-hmm. Third of all, there's a variety of different things that you can get and relatively inexpensive. It is a great round. And for most distances people are going to be shooting, I'm going to say between 300 and 500 yards is a max for the most part. It's a great round. If you have the capability to go more, go more. Like, I'm a big fan of the 6.5 Creed. We have several bolt guns now. I think we have three or four bolt guns in 6.5 Creed. I've got a gas gun in 6.5 Creed. Hunting rifles are in 6.5 Creed. I'm a big fan of that caliber because of what its capabilities are terminally on large game and also terminally at distance and my capability to shoot farther out. It's also relatively lightweight rounds, fairly inexpensive. It's easy to find. And like 308, it's popular enough now that I can find it just about everywhere I go. Didn't always used to be that way when it first became popular, but now it's that way. So I really like 6.5 Creed more. Other people are like, well, what about the? Then, yeah, that round, I don't care. Fucking pick one. What about really big rounds like 338 Lapua or 50 cal? Everyone wants a 50 cal. Here's the problem with those really big guns.
They suck.
Well, first of all, they're huge.
And heavy.
They're heavy.
Massively heavy.
Picking these things up and moving them is very quickly
Don't plan on covering a lot of field.
Man, when people are in the field, actually in the real field, not in the Call of Duty video game, I know everybody runs around with their Barrett and reloads it on the move and all that. Mm-hmm. You are not doing that shit in real world. In the real world, the Barrett is usually moved from location to location in the two pieces, upper and lower, like an AR-15, that it comes into. You know, magazines are stored separate. Like, no one's grabbing that thing for the most part. If it's vehicle-based, yeah, people are mounting them onto vehicles or they're hooking them onto vehicles. They're letting something else carry that thing because the weapon itself is incredibly, incredibly heavy. I mean, and it's very expensive to shoot 338 Lapuas and 50 cals before the panic were expensive.
Yeah.
When we got rid, I got rid of my Barrett. I had had one for professional uses. We kind of stopped using it professionally and we never even shot it. It's too expensive to shoot, man. $5-6 a shot. Like, after you shoot it a few times, you're like, I got it, man. I understand. And I've shot it so many times over the years that it's just like, whatever, man. I don't go out and shoot those things for fun. They're not particularly fun to shoot. They're not particularly comfortable to shoot.
And yeah, with those rounds, you have to have special targets to hit. Otherwise, you just decimate everything, and so that's another cost.
Now, if I'm practicing, yeah, I can't just shoot anything. It's like when someone shows up to our precision rifle class with a 338 lap, I'm always like, fuck, because now I'm like, okay, see, all you can't shoot any of these targets, you know, like 350 yards, that is your minimum, and even then they still typically break something.
Yeah.
Because there's so much energy, so much velocity. And I'm not shit-talking the 338 lap round. It's amazing.
But it's not practical.
But it's not very practical. Terminally, yeah, man, if I'm a military sniper and I might have to shoot something way the fuck over there.
Which is
what it was built for.
Designed for.
Then, yep,
the Canadians.
I want to shoot it way the fuck over there. And I want a ton of energy way past 1,200 meters, which is what that thing was built for, shoot like a freaking laser beam. And that's what it's for. I mean, these are guns that we zero at 300 yards. We don't zero them at 100.
Yeah. I mean, we've had a couple clients bring the Lapuas out to our precision rifle course up in Prescott area, and they struggle carrying that fucker around because we're constantly changing positions. Mm-hmm. We're constantly walking out distances. And it's like every time we sack up and start walking, they're always like, ugh, I shouldn't have brought this. And I heard a couple of them say, I wish I would have brought my other gun.
Yeah, I should have brought my 7.62. Yep. And they really start, you know, like we've had guys bring out like, you know, the 300 Remington Ultra Mags and stuff like that to a precision class. And by the end of the class, they're just like, man, you know, I was adding up what I just spent in ammunition and what everyone else just spent in ammunition. And yeah, I could have paid my mortgage for what I just spent in ammunition. You're like, yeah, you could have. You know, like, it's nuts how expensive those things are. And so, of course, the more expensive the rounds are, unless you just have tons of expendable income, the more expensive the rounds are, the less likely you are going to be want to go out and practice with it. That's why I like 7.62, 6.5, 5.56. Right? 5.56 is a great precision platform. It really is. I do a lot of competitive shooting. even out to 800 yards with specially designed 5.56 rifles. Now, those are really great, and they work pretty well in the wind, but I'll tell you, they decently, as long as you know what your wind holds are, I'll tell you, they start to dick out, you know, around 500-600 yards, like yeah. especially in heavy winds and all that. Even our very precision-built platforms are still kind of starting to dick out there, and then they're just not really making it happen. The other downside is terminal performance or kinetic energy or energy, impact energy in foot-pounds, right? Like how much impact is actually happening down there? It's just really not enough at these types of distances. At 100, 200 yards, all day long, yeah, it's fine. 300 yards, fine. Inside of 500, fine. But that's really what these things were designed for. They're not really designed to go past that. Will they? Of course. But that's not what they're designed for. So keep that in mind. We're talking about big calibers here, not the little guys, okay? We'll kind of talk about that here in a second. So let's talk about some basic optics stuff. And I'm not going to turn this into an optics show because we've already had those, and very easily I could spend another hour just getting started on talking about optics because there's so much to them. So I'm going to keep it really, really simple here. One, money spent on optics is always money well spent. Remember, you can always take an optic off and put it on a different gun. I would rather have better glass than necessarily a better gun. And people used to say, used to hear this a lot, the quality, you know, the price of the glass should rival the price of the rifle. I don't necessarily agree with that because I have, you know, I have a few $700 rifles with $2,000 worth of glass sitting on them, or I have, you know, $1,000, $2,000 rifles with, you know, $500 worth of glass sitting on them. It really just depends on the setup. So I don't agree with that statement. That's an old statement before things were so crazy in price. So just spend as much money as you can. If all you can spend on a really nice optic is a couple hundred bucks from Primary Arms or the budget line from Vortex or whatever, then man, that's what you got. Okay, so be it. I don't care. Like, do that. But the more money you can spend on an optic, the better off you're going to be for clarity, for features, for functionality, for durability, especially in this application. So here's some things I would look for in an optic for this. One, I would want the best optic I could afford. Two, I would want something in first focal plane. I don't want a second focal plane scope because I'm going to be shooting out past several hundred yards. Again, that's the application what we're talking about. So I want something in first focal plane so I don't have to worry about what power setting my magnification is on, and I can just use my holdovers and my wind holds. Because of this style of shooting, I'm probably going to be shooting using holds more than I'm going to be shooting using dialing. I want locking turrets when I can get them. If not locking turrets, I want stiff turrets or turrets that are very easy to see from the shooting position. I want to easily be able to see my numbers so I can make sure that I'm 100%. Plenty of times in competition have I accidentally turned turrets. Plenty of times in hunting have I accidentally turned turrets, pulling things in and out of packs, moving into different shooting positions. Plenty of times have I turned turrets. I either want them locking so that they don't turn. Sometimes I leave them unlocked, or sometimes I just have optics without locking turrets. Or I want the number so freaking big and easy to see that it's easy for me to look and go, oh, shit, I'm off. And that's a correction I make right before I shoot. Right before I shoot, when I'm in a position, I always check three things. I check my turrets, I check my magnification, I check my parallax. The next thing I would want, parallax. I want an adjustable parallax. I don't want a set parallax scope for this type of shooting. I want set parallax or adjustable parallax. For this type of shooting, because we're talking more about combative type shooting, I want an illuminated reticle. I want something that in the dark or in bad environments, I can absolutely positively see the reticle. Not just the center point, but the full reticle to include everything. Types of reticles I would want. I like a Christmas tree. I'm also a big fan of, you know, the Horus H59s. I like that reticle as well, especially if I'm going to be self-spotting. I need to be able to see where my impacts are landing. If I'm missing, I need to be able to see, and I need to be able to watch in my optic where the impact goes so I can make a measurement from where it impacted to where I need it to impact. I also want this Christmas tree or something like the H59 so I can quickly and easily hold. So what I need to look for in a Christmas tree reticle is something my eyeballs can see. I am farsighted. There are some reticles that are amazing reticles, and I wish I could use them, and I fucking can't. I can't see those tiny little numbers sometimes, my focus starts to drift in and out because I'm farsighted and I'm looking at something far away. And so my eye focus starts to drift in and out and the numbers get so blurry, I have a hard time with them, or the hash marks get so blurry, I have a hard time with them. So I look through reticles before I choose them. It's really, really important that you see the reticle and look at distance. Look at something 1,000 yards away. Look at something 500 yards away. Look at something 100 yards away. Look at something 50 yards away and make sure that at various different magnification levels with adjusted parallax and a focused objective eyepiece, that you can see the reticle clearly. And that's all based on your vision. Some people like super simple reticles. Some people like super complicated reticles. I don't really give a shit what you like. Do that. I like Christmas trees. Other things I'm going to look for in an optic on the gun, if I'm going to be using it for this kind of application, especially if I am choosing a semi-auto for close-up, is I want the capability to mount another optic onto it, something like a close-range red dot. You will find this on exactly zero of my setups. I have no offset red dots on any of my guns, even my carbines. It's not a thing I need personally. But if I was in this kind of setting where I may actually have to move and maneuver through a close range environment with this one setup, bolt or gas gun, I would absolutely have an offset red dot of some kind, something easy to see, a reflex. Probably I would get a full tube, so like an aim point series. I wouldn't get the normal open reflexes because I'm in this kind of environment, red dawn type shit, and I don't want that shit to break or get gummed up if I fall in the mud. I don't want the emitter to get all messed up or anything like that. So I want an enclosed tube, like the new Acro from Aimpoint or whatever would all be fine. Something like that that's enclosed. That's what I would want as an offset on my gun if I'm setting it up for the end of the world. Magnification range, most people over-magnify their optics. For most of what people are doing, 4 to 16, it's fine. 4 to 16 is plenty. If you want to go 5 to 25 because you want a big 50 millimeter lens or something, that's fine. You're just adding weight, and you may never need that magnification. Now, there is something to be said for high magnification if you are Uno Solo operator, and you do also need to be observing or identifying with this optic. So you got to kind of consider, am I living in the hills of Montana, or am I living in the suburbs of, Phoenix? Like, how far away am I realistically going to be looking? You might need that higher magnification just to see stuff, even if you're shooting on lower mag. So those are some of the features that I personally would look for in an optic. I would want an absolutely solid mount. Really solid mount, right? Could be one piece, could be two rings. I don't care what it is. I would also want range-finding binoculars. I'm a big fan of range-finding binos, and they're so available these days. So many different companies make them for relatively decent prices that I would highly, highly, highly recommend. If you want a rangefinder and you want binos, just get a set of range-finding binos. I'm a big fan of the range-finding binos. Personally, I use the Furies from Vortex. I think they're badass. They have the new Ballistic Advantage app built into them. SIGs have the similar setup. It's awesome. You can Bluetooth it to a device. If you're going to shut all that down because of the apocalypse, so be it. You can still just check the range, right? And so that gives you the capability to, within the binos, hey, I observe a target. There it is. Boom, hit a button, and there's my range, instead of having to use multiple different pieces of equipment. That would be what I would recommend, all right? A spotting scope, yeah, I would recommend at least a lightweight spotting scope. There's an 11 to 33 Razor HD spotting scope I have from Vortex. It might be one of my favorite spotting scopes that I use in the field because the thing weighs nothing. It is the lightest weight spotting scope I've ever seen. It's a great little 11 to 33. Obviously, mount on a tripod, set it up, prop it up on something, whatever, but it's an actually lightweight spotting scope I would use. Most spotting scopes are way too big. Like the spotting scopes I use in class to spot for people, I would never carry that shit anywhere. It's a boat anchor. A whole setup is a boat anchor. There's no way I would carry that thing anywhere. You know, it's beneficial when you can just pull it out of the truck, but not beneficial when you have to carry it. So that little Razor HD 11 to 33, that is hot. I'm telling you what, that's my favorite spotting scope. So if I was doing this kind of work, I would have that because I might need to do my own observation, uncluttered, whatever, from being on the rifle. I also, and I want to make sure that if I'm observing people that don't need to be shot at, I'm not observing them through a rifle. If I'm not sure what's going on out there, I don't want to be looking at everybody with a rifle in my hands. If I'm trying to identify friend from foe, which in situations like this, you guys, that's something most people don't consider, man. This is what, even the situation we're talking about here is incredibly sketchy already. It's going to be even sketchier when we can't identify friend from foe. So the ability to identify friend from foe is going to be really important here. And if you have a gun in your hand and they're looking at you, they're going to probably think you're a foe and engage you, because everyone's going to be pretty wound up tight in these kind of situations. So I would rather just have an optic, no gun. It's also good for other casual observation type stuff. It's easier to pull it up and look around and then put it away, hanging around your neck, whatever that may be. You're going to have – You're going to have three kind of spotter situations, and I'm going to outline these basically. One is no spotter available, where I'm going to be self-spotting through the scope. You're going to learn this technique by being a good spotter. Normally on a spotting scope, go out and learn how to spot well. Look, shooting competitions are always welcome to have volunteers. Shooting classes, even like ours, we have students who come out and they'll just hang out in a precision rifle class just to practice spotting so that they get more time spotting.
It's harder than shooting.
I think it's harder.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Shooting is fucking easy.
People have a really hard time calling hits, calling when, calling everything.
So that's absolutely something that you want to consider, is the capability to the capability to spot your own hits. Start with being a good spotter.
Yeah.
Then learn how to spot, self-correct, self-spot through your own rifle optic. If you have some rifle matches in your area, this is a great time to go out there and get some good hands-on time, even under a little bit of stress and under a timer, to go out and learn how to self-correct and watch other people do it as well, because your ability to do that's going to be huge. Most of this means you're going to want to crank down the magnification, make sure your parallax is tuned in, and crank down your magnification. Most of the time, guys, when I'm shooting at extended distances, I'm like 6 to 10 power at the most. Even if I'm 1,000 yards, I'm shooting 8 to 10 power. Like, I'm just not cranking this thing up a lot. It's just not particularly beneficial for, observation, potentially catching your own trace, watching your own impacts, things like that. If I have a trained spotter available, awesome. Work out with your team right now. Start today. That's the best time to make sure you have it good to go. If you have someone untrained or kind of recruited on the fly, so to speak, like, hey, you come here and be my spotter, here's the focuses that I would want them to have. My primary focus for that person would be to call out targets in a way I can understand them. That would be, if I had a minute to train somebody, it's like, get on this scope. Here's how the scope works. Back magnification way off, unless you need to zoom in on something, back it all the way back. Call out targets in a way that I understand it. Between the rock and the tree is not good enough. What rock, what tree? Be descriptive. Be over-descriptive. I'll tell you if I'm on or not. If I'm still looking, the more description you can give me, the better. You know, knowing your directions, knowing distances, estimating rough range. Hey, it's about 400 yards out. I don't care if it's 500 yards out. I'm at least looking in the neighborhood. Instead of I'm looking – is it 200 yards? Is it 1,000 yards? What am I looking at here? So that's what I would kind of work with someone on the fly, is just calling out as precisely as you possibly can. Use what you know and call out very specific stuff. Be over descriptive when you're calling out to start with, until we figure out our own communication strategy.
I would say a huge thing too would just be knowing your wind calls.
Yes, but for a spotter, that's developed. If I had an untrained spotter, yes, I would eventually want to train them on the wind. But as a trained shooter with an untrained spotter, I'm going to be making my own wind calls.
Yeah.
Because my spotter, if you've never seen wind, like literally, if I had to grab someone and go, come here, look through this scope, and call out targets for me, you know, we're going to shoot everybody who's wearing a blue helmet, for example, or something like that, right? That's not being specific. I just came up with that on the top of my head. Call them all out. Estimate a range. Tell me where they're around. Describe the person or the event to me, and then I'll be making my own wind calls. And if you're like, Josh, you don't listen to my fucking wind calls anyway when I'm spotting for you, so it doesn't really matter whether I give you fucking wind calls or not. Sometimes I give you shitty wind calls, Josh. Joke's on you, just to see if you fucking listen, and you still don't listen, so it doesn't matter. Anyways. Suppressors. Silencers. Yes, to suppress or not to suppress. Yeah, man. Understand it's going to add weight. It's going to change your data. So don't get unsuppressed data and think your suppressed data is going to shoot the same. It's not. So now you're asking, you have to have two different sets of data. That's going to be important. Thread on suppressors are always the best. You're always going to, it's a true to bore, you know, setup. And, you know, QDs have their own variances and tolerances in there. So a direct thread suppressor is always going to be more accurate over a QD suppressor. And it's, if you have multiple systems and you're, you know, tight on budget and you can only really afford one suppressor, great. Get a multi-cal suppressor from someone like, you know, Thunder Beast or Dead Air is kind of my new favorite brand that we're using a lot. Yeah. I love the Sandman S. That's like seriously one of my favorite suppressors ever in the world. I just love that freaking can. But look at, you know, those companies, get a multi-caliber can and, you know, maybe I share between my 7.62 rifle and my 5.56, carbine and my 22 gun I use for shooting rats to eat them while we're, you know, surviving in the wastelands. Great. You can take that and you can multi-cal share that and get good performance. You don't have to sit there and switch the end caps every time either. You're not getting that much more decibels by leaving a larger caliber, end cap on there. If you can dedicate a suppressor and you have that capability, awesome. Just remember that's going to make it longer and heavier and heavy specific. So, and you got to have different data. So that's really it. So now we want to look at, you know, a couple other concepts here, and that's going to be short range. So let's say we want precision, like we talked about in the beginning of the show, in an incredibly precise platform that's going to be shooting inside of a couple hundred yards, right? Close range precision. What are we looking for? I would go with whatever caliber you can get that will deliver you the most accurate, repeatable, consistent hit. I'm going to be using a gas gun in this world, by the way. Something that's going to be the most repeatable, accurate hit and the heaviest punch. So something like 300 Blackout is perfect for this setting. It shines here. That's where these calibers were made for. They were made to shoot close range, suppressed, and have massive amounts of energy delivered on target inside of 300 meters. You know, a suppressed AK here is beneficial, suppressed 5.56. The question comes, well, would you use a 22? That's something often people will ask. Would you ever consider that? No, I wouldn't. I know they used them in the tunnels of Vietnam. I know more people were assassinated during the Cold War and the Soviet Union. I get it. I know the history. I love 22s. I'm a 22 nerd. I love buying 22 rifles. I love shooting 22 rifles. I have a collection of 22s, 22 ammo. I love it. I love shooting 22s. They're awesome. Here's the thing. Not great for terminal performance. So if they're not great for terminal performance, why would I want to use them? I know they're good for assassinating people up close. I know all the stories. I get it. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the possibility to shoot an unprecise weapon hoping it's going to be precise. The same thing goes with all the other, you know, calibers that are common. 9mm. No, I'm not going to suppress and try to accurize a 9mm carbine. No, I'm not. Well, what about ammo availability? Okay, cool. Then yeah, if that's your thing, then fucking go for it. And you know, sometimes people argue like the silliest things, like, well, I want a platform because I go, well, look, if I was me, I would get, you know, a 5.56 in that range. Well, yeah, but I was thinking 9mm carbine because then all I'd have to do is just stock up 9mm and I could get an AR that would use Glock mags. And I'm like, well, you trying to fucking convince me? Sounds like you already convinced yourself. Just do that then. But understand the limitations of that platform. You're not going to get the same type of terminal performance. Remember, putting a longer barrel on a pistol round doesn't make it a rifle round. It just makes it a slightly faster pistol round. Still doesn't deliver the capability in precision or impact on target that a rifle round is going to allow for you. For me, just because I have so much of it and I'm so familiar with the guns, I pretty much just stick with 5.56 for this. Easy day. You know, so if it was me, I'm going to build a suppressed, probably second focal plane, 1-6, maybe 1-10 variable powered optic. Definitely with an offset dot and in 5.56. That would be my choice if I was going to do something like this. Great for doing all kinds of stuff. Also consider doing things like now, okay, let's talk about precision shooting, not soft targets. Not big soft targets. Let's talk about taking out dogs that will alert us. Let's talk about shooting out windows, shooting out lights. shooting vehicle tires, you know, shooting stuff like that when I just want to make a quick little entrance into this area and maybe set it up for a larger incursion or just reduce someone's capability to come after me or to detect me. Yes, that's when a suppressed 22, a nice little 16-inch, you know, suppressed 22 bolt action gun would be freaking rad. You know, our suppressed 22s sound like nothing. You press the trigger and you just hear click, mm-hmm. and then a bullet flies out at, you know, 1,000 feet per second. So, yeah, that's absolutely a case for that kind of gun. Definitely. For a good suppressed, you know, maybe even a 9mm. This would make that case for a good suppressed, you know, 9mm PCC or a 9mm bolt gun. They make them. I've thought about buying them. I think they're kind of a cool idea. But, you know, maybe you look at that kind of thing for that setting. I'm still, if it's going to be for being super quick and quiet and easy, I'm not going to run anything semi-auto and anything that's going to leave brass behind, right? So I want a bolt gun. I can control the brass ejection and I can control, because remember, if I'm trying to come in here and make a little disturbance and then leave and not just leave tracks all over the place, there's other stuff I'm going to be doing physically. We don't have time to get into that. But one of those things is sanitizing my area and not leaving brass behind. So a bolt gun allows me to control that. And it also allows me to control the operation of the action. In most suppressed subsonic rounds, like subsonic 22, subsonic 9, et cetera, the loudest noise is the action cycling. So if I want to be really no shit Hollywood quiet, then I want a bolt gun, and I'm probably just going to take a suppressed 22. A suppressed 22 with subsonics, you can get a lot of work done with that thing, a lot. So definitely a consideration. All right. In this outline, the two more topics. One of them's kind of funny, and this one's going to be quick. And that's ultra LARPing mode. Ultra LARP mode. Ultra LARP mode. Ultra LARP mode. Could you use these things for anti-aircraft weapons? Could you use precision tools to destroy equipment? Yeah, I just talked about that with the 22s, busting lights and windows and tires, stuff like that. If I needed to break larger stuff, you know, you get some 50 cal API, armor-piercing incendiary rounds, yeah, man, you can shut a vehicle down with that shit. You can destroy a weapons cache with that. You could, you know, on the ground, I don't know about shooting helicopters out of the air like the government thinks we do or like, you know, we talk about or see in Hollywood. I know it's possible. I know there's training that, you know, in the military that offers that kind of stuff. But I mean, for the average person, no, I'm thinking more about shooting stuff on the ground, right? If we want to take out helos or jets or things like, you know, vehicles while they're stationary and on the ground, yeah, man, those big-ass calibers. Small calibers can get some work done too, but those big, now we have a better case for the 338 Lapua, a 300 Win Mag, a 300 Rum, a 50 BMG, you know, something like that. Now we have more call for those types of tools. So sure, in ultra LARP mode, yes. But could you hit that stuff? Yeah, man.
Just don't hit the tires.
Is it accurate enough? Hell yeah. I can shut down a truck. We could shut down tires. We could shut down rotors on helos. We could shut down engines on jets. We could do all kinds of stuff with big fucking guns. But the problem is you're going to leave a larger signature. They're harder to get in and out of position. They're not as quick to move around in. And again, they're relatively expensive to shoot and also resupply. Again, we're talking end of the world type shit. So how much 50 cal am I going to have stored up?
Not a whole lot.
How much 338 am I going to have stored up? Probably not a lot.
Yeah.
So yes, in ultra LARP mode, yes. In actual Civil War, North versus South kind of shit, yep, I'm going to have that kind of stuff. It's basically artillery at that point.
Yeah.
I'm basically using it as a precise artillery piece to destroy equipment. So, yeah. Last thing we're going to cover here. Associated equipment. What would we carry?
Personally, us carry?
What would you carry? What would I carry if I was going to be a precision rifleman on the run in a sniper, counter-sniper type setting?
I'd carry my 6.5. That thing's light.
Well, now, forget the gun and think equipment.
Oh, equipment.
I mean, obviously I'm going to carry
my running shoes,
extra ammo and stuff like that, but footwear? Yep.
My trail running shoes.
I'm going to be in footwear that allows me to get up and get the fuck out.
Yep.
Because if I'm going to make a shot and then get up and run or make a couple shots and get up and move, I need something like that. I'm also going to be having things like, you know, moccasins and
Have you seen those
carpet shoes and stuff like that?
We were at when we were at the museum in Indiana, they had these shoes that were hooves that the Prohibition guys made.
Yeah.
I thought those were to hide, disguise their
foot. Looks like horses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was more for cows.
Oh, cows?
Yeah. Because they had the little prongs or whatever were. I thought that was an ingenious thing.
Sure.
So maybe I would make a pair of those.
I just wear carpet moccasins. Carbon moccasins work perfectly.
Look like a cow.
You can leave the cow tracks and I'll leave no tracks. How about that? And you want to now, Yanni, you want to consider things like, what am I be wearing? Well, is a ghillie suit appropriate? A ghillie suit is appropriate, but you have to consider what a ghillie suit actually is. When people think ghillie suit, they go instantly to the movies and all that. Mm-hmm. Look, man, we're in Arizona.
Paint your face.
I have a badass ghillie suit. I have a couple really sweet suits that I use for hunting. There's one. If the temperature's above 70 degrees, I do not even put this thing on my body.
Yeah.
It's actual, you know, jute, and it's an awesome suit, and it makes me totally disappear. And if it's above 70 degrees, it's about to be above 90 inside that suit.
Yeah.
So absolutely not. If it's not cold outside or cooler outside, there's no chance in hell I'm putting that thing on. So, and then, you know, you've got the airy, like these days you've got all this modern like 3D leafy camo and stuff. Man, yeah, go get one of those suits. They're awesome. And they're relatively inexpensive. $100 and you can get one. You can make your own. You know, consider putting other things in it. Like, now you're talking about building, you know, a hide and all that, which you don't have time to get into. But, like, yeah, there's other things I'm going to have to put in my suit. I want to look like nature. I want to look like that environment. Might need different colors. Might need different materials. You know, might need to get some of the local fauna and all that kind of stuff. Or flora, I mean, not fauna. Don't shove rats in your fucking suit. get the flora instead. But, yeah, you know, like, you want that look. But also remember, with all that extra shit hanging off you, that shit snags on stuff. It gets caught on fences. It gets caught on, you know, trees. It's hard to ditch and suddenly not be that guy anymore. Like, once upon a time, like, I was just a sniper. Now I want to go hide my sniper kit and go blend back into the populace real quick. You know, ditching all that equipment is just that much more bulky stuff that I have to stash, could be found, et cetera, et cetera.
I would think you would just want to wear hunting stuff. So
yeah.
Whatever your native land looks like.
Consider your normal camo stuff,
yeah,
for sure. And then think about draping stuff over your rifle. Like, drapes over your rifle are really important because, man, does a rifle – like a sniper veil, typical sniper veil is perfect. Damn, does a rifle profile stand out. God, have I have fuck stories about that, man. It's so fucking easy to see a rifle at distance. It's so fucking easy. So especially if it's not painted, you know, it's a black death stick.
Or I love it when people paint their rifles and then leave the suppressor black.
Yeah, that too. Like, or just black optic or whatever. You're like, you almost got it, you know. And it kind of depends on what we're looking for there.
Yeah.
But, you know, camoing your equipment is definitely something that you want to think about. It's easy to do with basic spray paint. You can change it and kind of mission adaptive as the environment changes. If you live in a really snowy area, you're going to need some white shit. You know, you're going to need a white jumpsuit. You're going to need, you know, and you can get the one with the speckled mud on it or whatever. But camo your stuff. For sure, you and your gear, consider that. However, you might need to blend into your environment. That doesn't mean multicam. Not all camo means multicam. It means blend into your environment, all right? Mostly, if I was going to do this, it wouldn't differ that much from my hunting or my competition pack. I'd have a relatively lightweight pack that would have all of my emergency survival essentials in case I needed to stay out there for a little while. It would have my communication equipment. It would have my navigation equipment. It would have, you know, extra ammo. It would have a secondary weapon system if needed in it, things like that. And then I would have something on my chest. I run with, like, the Hill People gear packs. I see guys run with chest rigs, especially if they're running a magazine-fed system, obviously. But the goal here is to be relatively lightweight, not kit yourself out like a fucking infantryman.
Yeah.
So you want to keep everything pretty slim, pretty trim. Remember, you're going to be on the move. You're going to be on the run. You're going to have to be sliding into small spaces. You're going to have to be disappearing onto the ground. A big, giant chest rig, body armor, all that shit is not going to help you disappear into those types of environments. So don't be bulky. If you want to be this kind of shooter, then you need to start practicing now. What's the bare necessities I need? Like a flat pack front rack that's literally like a radio maybe, you know, a med kit maybe, and, you know, a couple extra mags, and that's it. And it's super flat and super, you know, super close to your body. That way you're not trying to get down in the prone and you can't freaking lay down. So,
and guess what, kids? That means you have to work on physical fitness.
Physical fitness is going to be important here. Absolutely. You know, your cardio, your ability to get in and out of position. And with your equipment. There's a lot of people out there, man, who think they're going to be running and gunning through the hills, acting like, you know, fucking Marky Mark out of the sniper movie. Nope.
Yep. Good luck.
Probably not going to happen, right? Because you're not in physical condition to do it. But back in the, when I was in the Marine Corps, I don't want to hear about it. I don't give a shit. All right. You've drank 862 beers since then or whatever. Yeah. Like 8,062 beers probably
and
more realistically.
Weight shifts differently when you're running around.
Yeah. Now I put my gear on. I got my pack on. I've got this like everything I do. Like when I'm running precision rifle matches, especially when we're running action matches, everything is so fucking cinched to our bodies. We could full on sprint and it wouldn't come off.
Yeah.
Because we don't want it to mess with us. And it quick detaches. So if we need to get out of it, boom, pull a couple straps and whack, everything comes off so that I can get the hell out of it if I need to get into a different position because we're on the clock, we're under time, we're under that stress. So in environments like that, yes, I want that kind of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to train with it like Drew says. Things that are, you know, incredibly important in addition to the gun, you know, obviously the gun setup, I mean, I haven't like really mentioned bipods, but Atlas tends to be my go-to bipod. It's my most favorite. And a Magpul polymer thing has worked out pretty well. I don't own one, but I've seen a number of students come through programs with them without too much problems. We have broken a couple of them, but probably under situations where other stuff might have had problems too. But the Atlas is kind of my go-to. The SkyPod is probably the best one out there, but get ready to spend a couple bucks. You think Atlases are expensive? Go look up the SkyPod. It is a badass piece of gear, though. Quick mission adaptable for damn sure.
You can buy a house with one of those bad boys.
Yeah, and make a payment on a nice truck every month with one of those things. So just consider, you know, the equipment that you can put on your gun. Other than that, anything else that I've mentioned? I mean, not really. I can't think of anything else. You know, other than understanding most of this has to do, you know, your ballistic software. I use Ballistic Arc from GeoBallistics. It's my favorite one. I use their weather flow, weather meter, and I have a Kestrel. I mean, you know, wind meters and, you know, the ability to check your atmospherics are incredibly important. So you can apply that to your density altitude so you can change your data as appropriate, especially when you're shooting at long ranges. You know, yeah, these are precision shooting concepts are all important here. So you need the equipment necessary to be able to check that kind of information. But other than that, man, I can't think of anything real particular. If you're going to be moving in and out of environments like that, like always carry a pair of snips, you know, a small hacksaw, like one of the little folding blades. I can't remember what they're called right now because my mind is racing, but like a little bow saw kind of thing. It's not what it's called, though, but it's like a little fold-out saw. I can't think of what the hell. Fiskars makes them. Fucking Gerber makes one. It's just a little fold-out heavy-duty saw. Something like that, a good pair of pruning shears.
Good med kit.
Obviously, yeah, a good med kit. You know, things like that might be needed to cut, slice. If you're in an urban environment, I'm probably going to have, you know, a good, you know, set of pliers, a couple crescent wrenches for undoing things, bolts, you know, set of
that
tin snips for cutting stuff in. Maybe I might get, you know, those types of things. That kind of gets more into not shooting related gear, but. But for shooting specific stuff, for like building hides, yeah, I'm going to, you know, probably have some zip ties, some paracord stuff to hold things together real quick. A multi-tool, obviously, you know, things like that I need to consider. If I'm going to be building hides, those are things I'm going to need, you know, to consider. If I'm going to be punching, you know, murder holes out through walls, then obviously I might need even other tools like a freaking sledgehammer or something, which no one's going to bring. You know, I want to start thinking about how am I going to set that up. Shades,
yeah,
important to, you know, put over you to avoid glinting if the sun hits you just right, and to avoid that black outline of the rifle. Something like a sniper veil or a ghillie veil or something is fine. But yeah, I mean, there's we could go into a whole list of other stuff. I'm not gonna sit here and try to list out all the equipment, but just things for you guys to be considering in a civilian LARPing world of the precision rifle. Those are some considerations. Is that a complete list? No, because the show's only an hour long today. But those are some things for you to consider. That's what I got for you. Anything to add to that, Drew?
No, I think that covers it, you know. Just good gear. Make sure you train with it if you want to be the LARPer who's preparing. Train in your gear. You know, start, of course, I'm going to revert back to this, but if that's your game plan, start running with your packs on.
Yeah, know how to move.
Yep. Because you get gassed out very quickly when you start adding a bunch of shit. Let me tell you, as a trail runner, you keep adding shit, water packs.
Moving over varied terrain is no joke.
Yeah.
It's not like walking down the road. Nope. Some people are like, I can 12-mile ruck in under 3 hours Army Standard, and you're like,
yeah, cool,
bro. Let's see you do that over varied terrain. Like,
and run.
Varied terrain will fuck your ass up. Yeah, especially if I'm hustling.
Especially if you're having to run, yeah.
Yeah, if I'm hustling. All right, guys, independence training moment. Practice movement, speaking of, while doing other tasks in the shooting world. So if you're practicing for shooting, practice movement doing other tasks. Here's what we often see in force-on-force classes. As soon as someone starts talking in a scenario, they stop moving. As soon as someone goes to reload, they stop moving. As soon as someone has a malfunction in their gun, they stop moving. As soon as they start drawing their gun to shoot, they stop moving. A lot of people practice moving to shoot and then stop. A lot of people practice moving around, and obviously you move around and walk around all day, every day, but really practice doing other tasks. Spend a lot of time at the range, or if your range doesn't allow it, dry practicing on your own in your backyard or your garage or whatever, just performing those tasks. Verbals, hands-on, combatives. People get in combatives and they stop moving. Like I tell you, man, I'm a small person. I'm decently strong and decently skilled and fighting, but I am a small person. If I stand still, someone can grab me. And that's not good, right? I don't want to be attached to someone who's, you know, twice my size. Staying moving prevents that, by and large. Practice doing everything you can do in this self-defense world, moving. Drawing your light, moving. Using your light, moving. Calling on your cell phone, moving. Drawing whatever less lethal tools you have. My cops out there. God damn it, do I see cops do this shit. Because most of them only practice standing still. Drawing their tasers. Stopping to draw their tasers. Stopping to draw a baton. Stopping to pull out their pepper spray. Stopping to pull out their gun. Stopping when they're doing verbals. Stopping when someone physically engages them. Stop stopping. Start moving. Practice it. You're not going to do it just because you think it. You've got to practice it physically. Independence training brought to you, independent training moment, excuse me, brought to you by independencetraining.com or even easier, trainingaz.com. Remember, you can bring us out to train with you. You can get hosting information on how you guys can even train for free if you bring us out to you at info@trainingaz.com. So make sure you let us know if you're interested in bringing us out to your area. We're headed to Minnesota here. Still have several slots left in our Defensive Handgun and IFAC Lifesaver class, not this coming weekend, but the following weekend, September 25 and 26. We're working out our South Carolina dates right now. Probably going to be in late October, early November. So keep an eye on that if you're out in that neck of the woods. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and the social media type things. As the Arms Room Show, Independence Training, and MRC Phoenix, Drew's Running Club. And of course, Red Wire Gear, because we love him.
He said he'll be back next week.
That's what he fucking says. We're proud members of the Heroes Media Group. Remember to check out all the other services that they have. And honestly, if you're listening to the show and you've never looked up Heroes Media Group, first of all, Adam Bird, the guy who started Heroes Media Group and has put so much time and effort of his life into it, is not only a good man, he's a good father, he's a good friend, and he's a hell of a true professional. He has built something pretty damn incredible over at Heroes Media Group. Please, even if you've listened to the show forever and you're like, they always talk about Heroes Media Group, but you've never looked them up, please go look them up. Go check out their website, look them up on social media, see what HMG is up to. They got some really cool stuff that they're doing. Next week, we're going to be talking about prioritizing emergency preparation tasks with your family or your family group. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe, and train hard. You've been listening to The Arms Room.